We're doing Tanya 200, celebrating the 200th year since the first printing of the Tanya. The Rebbe has described in Tanya the powers and the garments of the godly soul. The godly soul, which is a little piece of God from above, has 10 powers. 3 of them are intellectual powers, Chachma, Bina, and Das. And then there are 7 emotions. And these emotions, like the love of God and the fear of God, are born out of the intellect, born out of the understanding of God's greatness, the contemplation of God's greatness, and so on. These emotions, then, are expressed through 3 holy garments: the thought, the speech, and the action of mitzvahs and of holy activity. Now, the animal soul, the natural soul, is similar, is an opposite image of the godly soul. So the animal soul, or the human soul, also has 10 faculties or 10 powers. There are the 7 emotions that are created and guided by the intellect, as we see that a child develops emotionally without any special effort. There's no particular effort to change the child's emotions from juvenile to mature and adult. What happens naturally is that as the child's mind develops, as his intelligence grows, and as the information in the mind is increased and improved, the emotions change accordingly without any special effort. So that as a child, the child will get angry over insignificant things and will rejoice and take pleasure in simple and insignificant things. And then as he gets older, the anger moves to different areas. He will now get upset about a whole new set of things, and he will take pleasure and enjoyment out of a whole new set of things. What moved his emotions from the simple, insignificant things to the more mature, to the more adult, to the more grown-up things? It's the intelligence that grew and changed, and the emotions change and grow according to the intelligence. This is not the same as in the godly soul, where the emotions are actually born out of intellect. In the godly soul, the intellect actually gives birth to the emotion, because the emotions, the love of God and the fear of God, are not natural to the human being. It's natural to the godly soul, but not to the human part of the being. And so in order to produce emotions concerning godly things, which are abstract and delicate and subtle, you have to actually give birth to that emotion from the intellect. And that's why those emotions are more subtle, are more elevated, they're more refined, because they are directly and intimately connected to the intellect that produces them. Intelligent emotions, so to speak. In the animal soul, in the natural soul, the emotions are guided by the intelligence. They have to remain within the bounds that the mind places on the emotions. We do not permit ourselves to have emotions that are irrational and destructive, because the mind will not allow it. We don't allow ourselves to get frightened over a non-existent danger, because the mind does not approve of that. So the mind governs and controls and guides the emotions, but it doesn't have the intimate relationship of giving birth to the emotions. Now, the intellect of the natural soul, of the human soul, understands creation. It does not naturally or effortlessly understand and relate to Creator. So, being a created soul, it is more comfortable with the creation than with the Creator. The same is true, of course, with the emotions. The emotions naturally gravitate towards that which is visible and knowable in creation rather than the abstract and subtle creator. Now, as in the godly soul, all these faculties, both the intellect and the emotions, express themselves, show themselves, through three garments. In the godly soul, they are holy garments. In the human soul, they're unholy garments, or non-holy garments. And those are, again, thought, speech, and deed. Now, when a person does, or speaks, or thinks, that which is forbidden, any one of the 365 prohibitions in the Torah, then for that duration, he becomes a vehicle for the unholy. He becomes a vehicle for evil. He is hosting in his mind, in his speech, or in his behavior, in his actions, he is hosting the evil, the unholiness, the sinfulness. Also, all thought, all speech, and all actions that a human being is capable of thinking, saying, or doing, or as the Rebbe says, all behavior under the sun, all of it is unholy and harmful to the godly soul, harmful to the spirit, as he describes in the Zohar, in the Kabbalah. Now, what are these things? All thoughts, all speech, and all action that are not related to God's will and to the service of God. In other words, there is no godly element there. It is purely human need or human desire. All of that is unholy or non-holy. Since it's not godly, it is ungodly or non-godly. And that's why in the Kabbalah, all unholiness is described as the other side. It is referred to as Sitra Achra, the other side. And what does the other side mean? What does that describe? What is that telling us? That unholiness doesn't have a positive definition. There is nothing you can say about unholiness that is true and descriptive. The proper way of referring to that which is unholy is simply by saying that it is not the side of holiness. If it isn't holy, then it's other than holy. And that's really what unholiness means, the absence of holiness. Just like darkness is the absence of light. And so in Kabbalah, the evil, the unholiness, is described as the other side. There are other terms as well that Kabbalah uses to describe evil, but the general term, the inclusive term, for everything unholy is other side, which means not part of holiness. Now, we need to understand the existence of both the holy and the unholy in the world, in creation. Being God's creation, how do things get divided into holy and unholy, godly and ungodly? God's creation and everything in it should be part of godliness, should be holy. The workable definition for our purposes here today is that the creations are divided into two functions. One is a direct increase of godliness, of God's presence in the world, and the other is an indirect increase of godliness in the world. In other words, there are certain acts, there are certain things in the world that are themselves godly, and doing them, speaking them, thinking them, increases the presence of godliness in the world, because God wants those thoughts, those words, and those actions for themselves, for what they are. Then there are those things that God created in the world as a means to an end. As, for example, we know that the existence of evil in the world makes us appreciate the existence of goodness in the world. Because there's a contrast when we see the darkness and the light side by side, then we appreciate the light as light and the darkness as darkness. So why does the evil exist? Why is there darkness in the world? To highlight, to emphasize, to strengthen the good and the light. So those things that exist as a means towards goodness, but are not themselves directly good, those things are called evil. Those things are called unholy. So what makes them unholy is the fact that God does not want them for their own purpose, but as a means towards an end, towards some other purpose. And we know, for example, in human relationships, that if we love someone for themselves, that's really love. If you love someone because of an ulterior motive, because of something you can get from them, if you're using them as a tool towards something else, then that love is certainly not a true love, and it can properly be described as hate, as despising. Because if you can't love me for what I am, and you can love me only for some other benefit that you can get from me, then the me is despised. The me is hated. At least relative to that which is loved for its own self, for its own sake. So unholiness in the world means all of those things that God created as a support for holiness, but it is not itself directly holy. So all thought, all action, and all speech that are not in some way serving God's will or for a heavenly purpose, all of these things are called unholy because they are not part of the holiness. They are not the side of holiness, so they are the other side. So to understand what unholiness really is, we have to define the Kedusha, we have to define the holy. Once we have a definition for holy, anything that is not included in that definition will automatically be the unholy. So what does holy mean? Holy can be translated, the word Kedusha or Kadosh, which is usually translated as holy, can also be translated as transparent. When God creates the world, His presence and His influence, the fact that He is creating the world, is concealed and lost in the process. When we look at the creation, we may not recognize that there is a creator to this creation. And even if we recognize that there is a creator, we don't always recognize the nature or the purpose or the intentions of the creator. And so the creation, the existence of created beings, in many ways conceals the creator, either his existence or his intention and purpose. But there are those things in creation that conceal God's presence to a greater degree, and there are those things that conceal God's presence to a lesser degree. And then there are those things that don't conceal God's presence at all. They are transparent in their existence. You look at them, and it brings the Creator to mind. They're transparent. A good example would be a king who has many ministers, many high-ranking officials. Now, some of these high-ranking ministers achieve their position because of their brilliance, because of their ability, because of their influence on other people, their ability to influence other people. And so they are truly ministers in whatever field that they're in because of their abilities, because of their natural talents, and because of their hard work. But it can also happen that the king, simply on whim, appoints an individual and gives them a position as a minister because he happens to like, the king happens to like this individual, because it's a family, because the king once received some favor from this individual. And this individual has no talents, is not at all capable of leadership, doesn't have the intelligence, doesn't have the ability. The king appoints him simply because the king has that authority, has that power to turn an individual from a nobody into a minister. Now, when you look at those people who became ministers by virtue of their abilities and strengths, you don't necessarily think about the king. You're impressed with the minister, and it's even possible to forget that there is a king because you're so overwhelmed by the talents, the ability, the authority, and the power of the minister. But when you look at the minister who became a minister only because the king on whim appointed him to that office, the first thing that comes to mind is the king himself. Because you look at this person and immediately you think, only a king could do this. Only a king can turn this person into a minister, because there's nothing in this person that is impressive or distracting of your attention, because he has no talents of his own. He is a minister only by virtue of the king's authority and the king's ability to appoint ministers. And so when we look at creation, there are certain things that draw our attention away from the Creator, and other things draw our attention to the Creator, depending on how transparent they are. Now, in unholiness, there are degrees of transparency, lesser or greater transparency. But holy means completely transparent. Because this creation, because this person, because this act is so closely affiliated with God himself, it is so much part of what God is and what God wants, that it blends into God himself and does not stand apart, does not draw attention away from God. So, for example, when you see a child saying a bracha, making a blessing over the food, you're not impressed with the child, you are conscious of the Creator whose will the child is obeying. In other words, you're seeing godliness itself rather than an impressively religious individual. Because the child doesn't have an ego, and his observance of the commandment is without self-awareness, and therefore does not distract the observer from the godliness that is the mitzvah. So holy means that which is so much a part of God that it does not draw your attention away from godliness and from God's will and from God's presence. Anything that has a self-awareness, anything that draws attention to itself, draws attention away from God, and therefore would be unholy, because it's not transparent. Where do we find creations, creatures, that are actually transparent all the time, so that godliness shows through them and God can be present through them or dwell in them all the time? The example would be an angel. Angels are such creations that they never took on a self-awareness. They have no ego. They have no purpose or function of their own, and therefore they are ministering angels or messengers of God, not because they have some spare time to go on an errand for God, but because they have no other existence at all. And so they are constantly and actually, not only in potential, but actually expressions of God's will, because they have no will of their own. So an angel is holy because an angel is transparent. And an angel is transparent because their entire existence is the expression of God's will. And that's why they're sometimes called messengers. Another example of transparency in the world, in creation, is the godly soul. The fact that a Jew, at least in potential, is always capable at any moment to give up his life for the sake of godliness. And this is true of every Jew, as we will see later on in Tanya. It's not the scholar and the saint and the rabbis who sacrifice their lives for godliness throughout Jewish history. It's the simple Jew. Sometimes the very ignorant Jew, ignorant of Jewish things, whose life was not devoted and dedicated to the service of God. And yet, on occasion, they would rise to the challenge and sacrifice their lives for the sake of godliness. And so, at least in potential, there's a transparency of self where a person is capable of giving up his life, his very existence, which makes him transparent for the sake of godliness, so he is transparent to God. And when he actually does that, then that potential becomes real, and you have in creation a factual transparency where people look at a Jew and think of God. God's people or the people of the book. So there's a certain transparency that brings God and the Torah, the Bible, to mind when one looks at a Jew. And that's why whenever there are 10 godly souls, whenever there are 10 people together in a room, even if they're not studying Torah or doing anything holy, the fact that there is a potential transparency in each of the souls, and you take those 10 souls together, that potential transparency becomes real and palpable when there are 10 of them together. And that's why the presence of God can be felt. The Shekhinah rests on 10 people, even if they're not learning or not doing a mitzvah, because of the transparency that they represent. But those things that are not transparent to godliness, those things that do not reveal their Creator, unless you analyze and get past the surface to discover that even this has a Creator, as the famous story in the Talmud, that one of the sages saw a man at the side of the road who was extremely ugly, physically ugly, being a reflection of his spiritual ugliness. And he said to him, "How ugly can you be?" And the man said, "Don't complain to me, complain to my Maker." And in doing this, the sage lifted some of the ugliness from this individual, because it was the first time that this individual actually recognized and admitted to a Creator. He had been so unholy, meaning so unaware and so alienated from his Creator, that the thought had never come to his mind. He never felt a dependency on a Creator. And that ugliness was what was showing on the surface. And when the sage said to him, "How ugly can you be?" he was in a sense asking him, "Do you take responsibility for your ugliness as well, being a self-made person?" And this forced the individual to recognize, to submit to the influence of a Creator, and he said, "Complain to my Creator." And that itself made him a little more transparent than he was before, a little more attractive. So those things that are not transparent, that do not recognize and admit to a Creator, those are not created out of God's inner will, meaning that God wants them for their own sake. They're created from the hind part, over the shoulder, so to speak. God gives them life because he needs them to exist, but not because he loves them for themselves. And so he gives life to these things, he creates them, and maintains them over the shoulder. Like when you have to deliver a package to someone you really don't like, you try to avoid looking at them. You deliver the goods, but you turn your face away and hand the package over your shoulder or from the back. So the word acher, which is the word describing other gods or other side, is also the same word in Hebrew for back, for the back. So God creates those things that are on the other side, on the opposite side of holiness. He creates them over his shoulder with his back turned to them, and that's another reason that they are called Sitra Achra, the side that comes from the back, from over the shoulder. And so this godliness that creates them, that sustains them and keeps them in existence, so that they not disappear and return to being nothing as they were before being created, this godliness that is given to them comes through so many concealments and so many contractions that there is very little left in the end by the time it reaches the creation stage, that there is very little godliness in these creations. And even the little bit of godliness that is there is uncomfortable in its location. It is in exile, so to speak, within this unholy creation. However, as we said earlier, in unholiness there are two different kinds. There are those unholiness that are completely opaque, that don't allow godliness through at all, and these are called the three dark klippa, the three dark shells, just like a shell hides the fruit within it. The peel hides the fruit, conceals the fruit that is in it. The unholy conceals the godliness that it contains. The little bit of godliness that it has, it conceals and denies. So there are those things that deny the godliness completely. Those are the things that are prohibited, that are sinful, like the non-kosher food, non-kosher relationships, working on Shabbos, and so on. These things are completely dark klippa. They are completely opaque. But then there are also those things that come from a brighter shell, a brighter klippa, which we might describe as translucent. They conceal, but not completely. They hide the light, but yet you're aware that there is a light there. So you can't see exactly what the nature of the light is, but you know that there's a brightness there. And that's what translucent means. So those things that are prohibited are completely dark, the opaque unholiness, and those things that are permissible but not mitzvahs, so that there's no holiness to them, but there's also no sin in them, those things belong to the category of translucent, of the things that are neutral and can go either way. They can either become holy if used properly, or they can become completely unholy if used selfishly.